This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. Today, we're talking about how we can fight COVID-19 with data. Every day, the Director General of the Ministry of Health, Malaysia, stands behind a podium and presents us with numbers. Numbers of COVID-19 infections, deaths, recoveries, number of patients still being treated, number of clusters and tests being done every day. And all of this is data that gives us information, which is really key in our efforts to handle the COVID-19 pandemic. So to tell us more about the value of data in a public health crisis, I'm speaking today to Dr. Desi Baharaja, a public health medicine specialist and also co-founder of Young Digital Leaders Malaysia. How are you doing, Dr. Desi?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Good.
Dr. Desi, first tell us more about Young Digital Leaders. What is it? Why was it set up and what do you do?
So basically, YDL or Young Digital Leaders is a group of young scientists, mathematicians, data scientists, Malaysians all around the world, like basically coming together to solve the global grand challenges in healthcare. That's our main aim. So the whole idea why me and Dr. Anwar, who's also the co-founder of YDL, the main reason why we set this up was to actually encourage young minds to develop creative and critical thought process, to spur the young to question status quo, challenge conventional schools of thought, allow this kind of dissent, contestation of ideas. In other words, basically what we wanted is actually to have a diverse yet universal in thought in terms of data-driven decisions.
And the focus is on data, the focus is on digital. Why is that?
Yeah, so currently, as we know, what we see around us today is a democratization of data. So democratization of data is there's many sources of data available in the internet today. So what we are trying to do today is, besides government giving their views, what YDL tends to do is also to look deeper in giving insights to Malaysians. So what we do is we combine, we collate, we analyze, and we disseminate information to the public. So because why we felt that data-driven decision is the key for better policy making.
The Ministry of Health is releasing data. Of course, we depend on them as the official source of this kind of data. Why is it important then for, you know, other people to come in and to analyze it?
So basically, I think what's important here is what you clearly ask is actually transparency and immediacy of data, right? So I think it's important to have this transparency and speed of data sharing across the board. I mean, not just among government institute, but even to the private sector, to the academia, because that actually enables innovation. So why when I say enables innovation? Because if you see AI, predictive analytics are all based on data input. So the moment if governments or the moment an institution doesn't share data, it will actually hinder the growth of new innovations respective to any sector. So we're speaking about healthcare per se. I think it's important for governments to share data, like what we clearly see. I mean, even in Malaysia, in Singapore, in South Korea. I think the moment when we share data, things like mobile app development can materialize. Automating of contact tracing can be done. So where only when this data is being shared, like I clearly said, I think that's when we can have heterogeneity of data or we can have various different data, because having data based on what is reported is one thing, but having to combine them with environmental data, with traffic data, with GDP data, with the economic data, I think that gives us a better insights on a holistic problem. So I think that's why it is very important for governments to actually share data, and also the speed of sharing is also very important for real-time analytics.
Okay, all right. So when we talk about data, if you can break it down as simply as possible for us, what kind of data are you talking about when we are looking at public health to improve health outcomes of a population?
So basically, the conventional way of using data is to actually monitor a country performance is basically mortality rates. So what we do is we benchmark ourselves based on maternal mortality rates, infant mortality rates, below five mortality rates, and even life expectancy, I would say. Mm-hmm. But another aspect of public health outcomes that we see today in the modern world is we are also starting to evaluate or the types of data that we use to evaluate is also user or patient satisfaction. I mean, that's very important in our setup today. Secondly, things like waiting time, like lab turnaround time in order for you to get a result. Things mm-hmm. like turnaround time for getting a surgery done. So I think public health has evolved so much that it's not just about mortality rate and life expectancy today, but it's even the medical services given in a particular country. So those are basically the main bulk of how data is being used in public health mainly, yeah.
And especially in a public health crisis like the COVID-19, you've already explained, you know, it's important for official sources of data and looking at environmental traffic data. Could you explain what those terms mean, environmental data and all that?
So if you see in public health crisis, for instance, let's take dengue, right? Mm-hmm. So having the data of reported case alone might not help us to make decisions. So what is more important here is only when we have, as you know, dengue is a vector-borne disease, so it relies a lot on the environment. So if we can couple these reported cases of dengue with environment data such as wind speed, thunderstorm, wind radiation, rainfall, geographical terrain, elevation of an area, types of roofing of a building, the population density of the area. So I think these are all what we call the external variables, the non-health related variables. So I think why YDL is here today is to actually look into how can you actually combine, how can you collect, collate, analyze, and combine all of this data to actually make sense. So if you see one of our recent report in YDL in terms of benchmarking countries in terms of stringency index, if you see what is presented in the stringency index in Oxford is just about how stringent a policy is. But what we did further was we actually combined the stringency index with the testing capabilities of each countries. We even combined to the trends of the cases of each countries. We combined with the trend of deaths of a country. So only when you combine certain parameters, it's easy for policymakers to make decisions.
And what happens when policies are not made based on data?
Okay, so I think that's a very, very good question here. So I think when policies are made based not on data, I think it's like sailing in uncharted seas without navigation system here. Mm-hmm. So you won't arrive at the expected destination. So I think why it is important to have data, because policies made without sound data lacks accountability. So it's everyone keeps blaming each other when there's no real data-driven decisions there. And furthermore, it also the inability to assess effectiveness of the policy made, because it's all about anecdotal, it's all about assumptions, it's all about a hearsay. So I think having data is like having a compass in your hand. So with the right data, you can make the right decisions, and not just decisions, but like I clearly said, even decisions for interventions in public health, even decisions to see whether the policy that was drafted 3 years ago is today or not. So I think that those are very important points there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll take a quick break. And now I'm talking to Dr. Desi Baharaja, public health medicine specialist and co-founder of Young Digital Leaders Malaysia. We're discussing the value of data in public health, in our healthcare, and specifically, of course, with the COVID-19 pandemic, data is key. The case in any public health crisis, data is key because you can formulate policies, make decisions, quick interventions and decisions based on the data, and then you can assess it. So YDL has been doing a few analyses recently based on the data that's coming out. So when we come back from the break, I'd like to ask Dr. Desi to elaborate more on what those findings have been. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Ik, and on the line with me is Dr. Desi Baharaja, Public Health Medicine Specialist and co-founder of Young Digital Leaders Malaysia. So Young Digital Leaders, or YDL, is a group of scientists, Malaysian scientists from all around the world, doing their own collation and analysis and dissemination of publicly available information related, I guess in recent times, it's been related to COVID-19, but there's a lot related to public health decisions that can be looked at. I like the term you use, Dr. Desi, democratization of data. Is that a relatively new concept, the democratization of data?
Yeah, definitely. I think decentralization and democratization and demonetization of data is definitely the way forward. Mm-hmm. Because those were the days, if we see that most important data or most important innovations are only carried out by government institution. I'll give you an example. All this while, the space industry is always governed by the government of the United States, which is done by NASA itself. But today you see a company called SpaceX by Elon Musk is basically a private company that is moving towards space industry. So we are seeing that with the democratization of data, decentralization of data and innovation, even a layman, even a public citizen, or even a private citizen, even startups can start moving towards new innovation. We are seeing a great shift now from great expensive innovation that's been done by government is slowly moving towards the normal man today. Yeah.
But when private sector comes in towards a space that was previously sort of owned by a public authority, doesn't that commercialize it? And what would be the implications of that?
Yeah, so definitely there are pro and cons here. So I think, for example, there should be some kind of guidelines or some kind of rule of law that should be in place. For instance, I like to relate back to the space industry. In fact, it was more expensive when the government was running the space program as compared to when a private space industry was actually running the space program to launch microsatellites to orbit Earth. So it all depends. I think I wouldn't say that moving or shifting certain innovation to private sector will cost more, but I think it's how we actually do it, how are the methodology, how are the mechanics that we actually put in place. Yeah.
And then if I were to bring it back to the use of data in healthcare, I think one concern when data becomes widely accessible is... And I suppose this is a very specific example, but the concerns of insurance industry using patient data in order to, you know, affect premiums and things like that.
Yeah. So I think when we talk about data sharing, there are many people that jump the gun immediately saying that, oh, they are going to share our data, they're going to exploit our data. I think what we are speaking here today is We are talking about data sharing here. We are talking about democratization of data. But when I say democratization of data, what I really mean here is democratizing anonymized data. We are not talking about sharing personal identifiable data. We are not talking about sharing your name. You're not talking about sharing your IC and etc. So I think people got to be very clear in this. I think that's because the only way forward in order for us to innovate, in order for us to move forward, this exponential growth, I would say, is to actually embrace the new way of doing things without compromising, data security and data privacy.
Mm. And decentralization, I mean, you already mentioned earlier about transparency and immediacy in sharing data. When does it become a national security concern? And I suppose that's where Some countries, governments may hold on to data, citing those kinds of concerns.
Yeah. So exactly. So that's one of the reasons why I think in terms of governance, I think most government today should start employing or should start creating new job space, as you know, those we have a lot of data scientists currently in Malaysia, even in Southeast Asia. I think we in government institutions should start embracing or employing these people, because I think it's important to have the right people at the right place to make decisions. Because when these people are there, I think we can they can clearly understand which data is of national security concern and which data probably might not tickle or might not cause problems to the country. So when we don't understand, or when we don't divide them properly, when we don't stratify them properly, this whole confusion basically disables innovation, because everyone tends to jump to the final say, that is, oh, it is because of national security concern, it is because of personal identifier variable, or and we are not too sure whether this data falls in which section, so we are not going to allow this. So that actually stops innovation indirectly.
Okay. So let's look at what Young Digital Leaders Malaysia has been doing. You started fairly recently, I think, right?
Yeah.
And of course...
A few months back.
And of course, it's been right in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. So a lot of your work has been looking at that. And with COVID-19, there are a lot of big questions. Like, I think right now, everybody's asking, well, we've sort of eased the restrictions of the MCO. Has the MCO at all been effective in reducing the cases? So I'd like to ask you to elaborate a little bit on your analysis, looking at benchmarking the Malaysian government's response on COVID-19 and benchmarking that to other key countries. So can you walk us through very briefly what were your findings?
Okay, so basically what we found was there was a wide-ranging responses that have been launched by various countries around the world since the onset, right, of COVID-19 pandemic in their bid to actually minimize its toll for the shortest time possible. Everyone was trying to find what could be the best exit strategy here. So, with some governments either throwing all their resources possible on one end of the spectrum, while others were opting a bit more liberal approach. So basically, minimal restraint and relying upon good public literacy and also self-regulatory of social measures, like what we see in Sweden as well in South Korea. But based on our analysis for Malaysia, what we found was Malaysia's strict public control measures, when I'm pretty sure the government of Malaysia has already assessed the public literacy and, you know, various other factors, socio-demographic factors, before coming up to what could be the best tactics in order to solve COVID-19. So what we found when we analyzed the trends of death, trend of cases, as well as the testing capacity and also their public policies, what we found was Malaysia's strict public control measures were implemented in three phases from the onset. The number of official cases and death peak gradually attaining and almost, of course, and almost a plateau like crescendo with a decline following. The tests were incrementally instituted over time. Contact tracing is a very important component, is an ongoing exercise, of course, that is being carried out by the Malaysian government to limit the spread of epidemic. So the government's recent policy in gradual retracting the movement control and subsequently results will be much more, I think, anticipated over time, both as we see. But I think one of the key finding what we found here was the extensive testing or rapid lab turnaround time that was done when Malaysia was pivotal in arresting the chain of transmission, because as you know, timeliness in attaining real-time data is opposed to lag time data, of course, does not allow us to assess the real burden. So I think one of the key message what we saw was taken by Malaysia was testing capacity and MCO was, I think, one of the key strategy or key tactics, I would say, not strategy, key tactics that was used to actually arrest this whole COVID cases. But countries like Sweden and Korea, the success of less stringent policies were undertaken. Probably it appears to be more possible where communities had high literacy on self-imposed social restriction, as compared to our country, yeah.
Okay. And contact tracing has been cited as another key tactic. Especially Malaysia, we right from the beginning, contact tracing was implemented in a very rigorous fashion as well, right? You want to talk a little bit about what your findings showed with regard to the success of that aspect?
So basically, based on our findings on benchmarking various countries based on the stringency policies, what we found was when we compared South Korea, China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, UK, and also Malaysia, I think what the common denominator here was actually tests. It was about tests and trace. So test is something that you have to do, but how do you test? So that comes the contact tracing part. So how do you test? So some countries, they use manual contact tracing. So they tend to have a longer lag time there in order to get the right people to be tested and quarantined and treated. Whereas country that embraced automated contact tracing got the chance to actually test their population even at a faster rate. So I think the take-home message, what we saw based on the various analysis, is extensive and timely automated contact tracing and testing is still the yardstick to gauge the success apart from cure rate. Yeah.
What do you mean when you say automated contact tracing? Because I think Malaysia, we still do it the pretty conventional way of interviewing and calling people, right? How is automated different?
So I think whether a country is automated or not, I think the fundamental epidemiology or public health intervention of manual contact tracing will definitely still carry on. It is an automated contact tracing does not just replace the manual way of doing things, it actually complements. So what actually we mean by automated contact tracing is, for example, when we share information about our contacts. So, I mean, to recall your contacts, what you did in the past 14 days, that is one incubation period, it's quite difficult because you can only recall the people you meet or the people you know. Mm-hmm. But a security guard that opens the door for you to enter a bank is someone that you probably won't know. So I think the whole idea of what the whole automation of contact tracing that the Malaysian government is doing, Singapore, South Korea, is actually to enable us to share our contacts. So when I say share our contacts, it's not our phone numbers or what, it's an encrypted version of contacts that when you're on your Bluetooth service, so between you and me, when we even if we don't know each other, but we come close around 2 to 3 meters, it shares this handshake, whereby this handshake will be encrypted and kept in your phone. So in the event that if someone is infected, so that's when the government will call you and seek your permission if he's able to trace the 14 days. Probably with that information, he'll be able to decrypt those handshakes and actually find those contacts that you have met. So it really depends on how you look at it. So there comes questions of privacy and security and etc. But I think at the end of the day, we got to call the shot and decide what we actually want.
Yeah. Okay, all right. And will you be looking at the impact of the CMCO now, the conditional MCO?
We are still monitoring. So if you visit the YDL website, the pictures that we shared are not still pictures. Those are updated every 2-3 days. So yeah, we are still continuing to monitor them. Yeah.
Yes, because that will give you another big set of answers, won't it? About
exactly.
I mean, what can we learn, or how do we use these analyses to figure out the so-called right exit strategy for Malaysia?
So okay, this is a very, very tough question. Everyone speaks about exit strategy.
That's right.
So there are many unknowns about COVID-19. Let's be fair. There are many unknowns about COVID-19. But one thing is for sure: every possible way out is riddled with hard choices. It's there. So before moving towards exit strategy, I think I would like to share a little bit. So there are a few differences between tactics, strategy, and goal. So when we talk about strategy, strategy is like trying to turn around a plane, an aircraft. So it's definitely can be done, but it can't be done fast. Whereas tactics are specific actions that are undertaken to accomplish a strategy. So like I said, tactics, strategy, goals. So when we talk about MCOs, closing down schools, restaurants, and etc., keep in mind those are actually tactics. Those aren't strategy. I mean, but some people will argue. So those are actually tactics in order for us to achieve a strategy. So to me, the strategy is how do we find ways so that our population has exited the infection? We must understand that the whole point of the strategy here is we are trying to think of ways on how can we exit the infection. The lockdowns or the lockdowns or the MCOs only buys precious times, but they are not a strategy. Obviously, when you do lockdown, the immediate fire is extinguished, but the population remains vulnerable as large numbers lack the immunity still for COVID-19, right? Mm-hmm. So like I said, the strategy will be to achieve the herd immunity, to achieve the natural immunity, But how do you actually achieve that? So there's only two ways to achieve that. Number one is either by infection. Number two is either by vaccination. And as you know, vaccination takes a lot of time because there's a lot of effort, clinical trials, safety, and et cetera, that needs to be done. On the other hand, when you said infection, there comes the ethical question of, are you going to allow certain populations to be infected, high-risk people to die, and et cetera, is what been taken by some governments, other governments' approach. Mm-hmm. So I think it's like I said, it is no one size fits all kind of strategy. But we know at the end of the day, herd immunity is a destination, and of course, it's our goal. But how do we do that? It's still very challenging. So that is one of the reasons why when we talk about MCOs lockdown as a strategy, we actually went into depth, me and Dr. Wayon, if you see, we just published the paper. So what we mentioned there was, yes, I mean, our only tool currently today is to understand the social demography. So when we understand the social demography, we see public literacy. If our public literacy is not so good, okay, then we will move towards MCO and lockdown. But when you move towards MCO and lockdown, there are some variables that needs to be seen, I mean, that needs to be analyzed thoroughly. So for example, number one, how fast do you start an MCO? Number two, the duration of MCO. Number three, the intensity of the MCO. So lifting an MCO too fast can be also detrimental. And also prolonging an MCO too long can also be counterproductive.
I suppose along with the question of how we exit the infection is also when we would see that happening. Mm-hmm. And how does modeling come into play to look at the trend of the infections? If you could explain a little bit. I mean, modeling is a term we hear used within the context of epidemiology. What does it mean? Mm-hmm. And how does that come into play here?
Yeah, I think modeling basically has been done by epidemiologists. Modeling has been done by computer engineers, by mathematicians, and etc. But I think modeling remains as modeling until we see some kind of assurance in our model as compared to what's happening on the ground. So, and we can't rely 100% on modeling as well, because modeling is just a mathematical tool that, probably doesn't understand the real interventions, that doesn't understand what's going on the ground. So hence, I think it is important to do real-time modeling, continuous modeling, and that usually has been done through AI to machine learning and etc. So the question is now, what does the modeling tell us? So for example, I think based on the modeling that YDL has done, and I think even Imperial College has done, and various institutions has done, I think we all know that COVID is going to stay with us for quite some time. It's definitely going to stay for probably maybe a year or two. It's going to be there. But I also think, and this is my personal opinion, doesn't represent anyone here. So, and I personally think we also need to understand this whole, this whole lockdown and this whole idea of lockdown and MCO, because what I'm seeing today, some people think that lockdown is the exit strategy. Keep in mind, like I said, we do not, however, have a real exit strategy, because the final exit strategy is herd immunity. So keep in mind that lockdowns, we don't actually save lives with lockdowns, but we only buy extra time so that lives can be saved. Mm. I think people need to understand that very clear, you know, because vaccines, yes, they do save lives eventually, but lockdowns, we don't indirectly save life, but we only buy time. Like I say, we are trying to postpone all the cases so that extra time can be bought in order for us to save lives. So when the extra time is bought, I mean, we tend to increase our hospital capacity, or, you know, our ventilators, etc. So going back to your question, modeling. So I wouldn't rely 100% on modeling. I think modeling needs to be tested, and it has to be peer reviewed from various institutions, because relying alone on one modeling might be biased, of course. And also, you also got to know that who's actually doing the modeling. So that's when, like I said earlier, democratizing of data is very important. So when you democratize data, you allow public, or you allow people to challenge the model that you have created, because everyone will be using the same source of data here. So probably the academia will come up with one type of modeling, the MOH will come up with one kind of modeling, you know, a few data scientists will come up with their own modeling. So, I mean, it's a healthy thing, because like I said, contestation of ideas will be there, and probably you could, you know, extract the best knowledge possible in order to move forward.
But if your modeling comes up with different outcomes, isn't it confusing for the public?
So that's why it's very important to actually have a coalition or a technical committee that actually goes through various modeling. So if you see some countries, right, they have this thing called the CTO of the country. Like I think in the United States, there's a position called the CTO of the United States. So I think what's important here is the chief technology officer will actually look into various modeling, and they will organize a meeting with various academia and also various institutions, and come and decide what could be a debate about the model. So what could be the possible best model that is more reliable in terms of relaying it to the public? So you're absolutely right, because various ideas can be confusing, but that should be challenged and that should be contested in a proper way before it is being relayed to the public.
Mm-hmm. So basically, like any scientific methodology, its validity needs to be tested and questioned, taken apart and put back again, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah.
All right.
But that also, I mean, and the whole point is, you know, we can't keep saying that, you know, your methodology is right, my methodology is wrong. I think it has to be presented. It has to be contested. So only then, you know, we can come up to what could be the right, the best methodology, the best reliable studies, and the best outcome.
Mm. I mean, so now, Dr. Desi, I mean, YDL is basically in a position where it relies on the availability of many different sources of data. So how would you assess the environment that we're in terms of the data that's being made available, the transparency of it, or the immediacy of it being shared?
I think Malaysia has moved really fast and really forward as compared to where we were 10 years ago. And if you can see, even the Director General, I mean, almost every day there are updates on data, you know, on the specifics, and even there's Google Sheet form available for us to extract available open source data. So I think we are moving there. We're heading towards rapid real-time data sharing. It takes 2 more years before we have a global hub or open source website whereby anyone could actually tap anonymize data for us to actually, you know, create more analysis in that. Because I think one of the biggest challenge, not just Malaysia, I think any countries, I think some of them are, like I said, reluctant to share. Number one is because of anonymous, and because of trying to understand the privacy and safety reasons. Secondly is, you know, like you clearly said earlier, you know, when there is various modeling, people will get confused, and which is a more reliable model. I think that is one the second reason why some countries, not Malaysia, but some countries are still reluctant to share. Mm-hmm. And I think the third reason is, unable to probably accept different opinions. So I think once we move towards the change of mindset, so I always tell people, it's not a big data problem, it's the big mindset problem that needs to be changed first, you see. Mm-hmm. So only then we will see the use of big data in a more rapid way.
Yeah. Absolutely. Dr. Desi, just to wrap up, you said that the prevalent thought is that COVID-19 will be within the community and within our population for at least a year or two. What kind of data will you be sifting through and analyzing in order to figure out what we can expect in this year or two?
So I think what's important now is, I think, which MOH is already doing it, is the number of cases data, the number of deaths that we have. And I think furthermore, if I think it's quite difficult for MOH to do it, but I think if we start getting real time in terms of admission rates, discharge rate, as well as the bed occupancy rate, as well as the ICU bed occupancy rate, I think that will be very helpful for actually analyzing whether the healthcare system will be overwhelmed or not. That's one thing, but keep in mind that's very difficult to do it, because I think it needs more effort, and most of the work we have today is still on a manual basis. So it might be difficult. Probably it'll take MOH maybe in the next 3 to 5 years to be able to share those kind of information. Mm-hmm. But I think those are quite pertinent information for us to analyze the whole. And of course, that is one component of it. The second component would be, of course, the test results. It's important not to just share positive test results, but it's also important to share negative test results. I think that will allow us to create, you know, better insights on specificity, sensitivity of the whole given scenario here. Precision, mainly, basically, the precision of the results, or the precision of the intervention that we are trying to do. Mm. And the third component would be non-COVID related deaths. Because a lot of people tend to forget about, there are a lot of non-COVID that is also happening now, because everyone is so focused on COVID, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's also very important to assess the whole burden of disease. It's not just COVID-19, but as a whole health system perspective, yeah.
Mm, absolutely. And, you know, all of that is going to come down to having a very robust digital health system, and that's something that we've been talking about for a long time, but we're still not there yet. And
yeah, I think like I clearly said, so when you compare various industry, retail, finance, health, I think healthcare has always been lagged behind as compared to finance, retail, logistics, because I think there's a lot of trust issue involved, there's a lot of privacy issue involved. So I think hence you see health always taking the backseat in terms of innovation. So because of, not because they want to, but I think because of all these stringent policies in place in order to protect the people or the patient. So hence we tend to see this lag, yeah.
Mm. Well, that's a conversation we'll have another day. Thank you so much for speaking to me today. So on the line with me has been Dr. Desi Baharaja, Public Health Medicine Specialist and co-founder of Young Digital Leaders Malaysia. We've been talking about the use of data in how we can figure out the exit strategy for COVID-19. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.